The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
A number of years ago, a student came into Israelite and they were wearing a t-shirt. And on the front of it was a Calvin and Hobbes comic strip. And it was very special. I don't know if you're familiar with Calvin and Hobbes. Calvin is a little boy and Hobbes, or maybe I've got it backwards, Hobbes is a toy tiger. And Hobbes turns to Calvin and he says, "Calvin, do you believe in God?" And Calvin's sitting there with his hands behind his head and pondering. He says, "Well, somebody's out to get me." When I read that, I thought that was really funny. Then I thought about, why is that so funny? And I think it's funny because we can relate to it. You know, we kind of, the talent of a comic strip is they address certain things that we deal with that which we often aren't even aware of, and almost has the courage to say things that we maybe not even have the courage to say. But when you say God, what does it really conjure up? What is one's reaction? What does it trigger? What does it trigger? You know, the first step in really getting to know Judaism is to get in touch with what you already think you know about Judaism. The real first step in really moving into a program like this is really unpacking your baggage. And I'm talking about psychological baggage. I'm sure we've got all kinds of baggage, and I'm sure there's not enough room in the dorms where you put it. But I'm talking about getting rid of certain baggage. We can't imagine how much baggage we really have about Judaism, right? And I've been involved in Jewish education for about 15 years now, and a tremendous first step to really get to know ourselves as Jews and really get to know our own heritage, our own teachings, is to get in touch with what we think we already know, and to get in touch with the various experiences, the various images, the various definitions that are actually stifling our ability to begin to really grow and get past it. When I was working with this Jewish organization in the States, it's a very large Jewish organization, I was hired to do Jewish programming. It was a very unusual thing that they actually hired an Orthodox rabbi to do Jewish programming, because it's not an Orthodox organization, but they took a chance and they decided to do that. I told them that I don't want to be introduced to the members of the organization, of this youth organization. I don't want to be introduced as a rabbi, because I felt like once they'll know I'm a rabbi, I'll never get anywhere with them, because the word rabbi just throws up all kinds of walls and images and expectations and discriminations. I don't want that. So I said, you know, don't call me rabbi. All right, fine. Well, so what? I get the newsletter. I say, "Here, rabbi, we just sent this out as a news bulletin about the fact that you're working, and so, you know, we were very careful. We didn't call you rabbi." Right, so I start reading this news bulletin, which is introducing this new member on staff. "We want to welcome David Aaron, our Judaism specialist." I said, "Oh, great. That sounds not too much more offensive and silly. As a rabbi, it's going to sound like my Judaism specialist. What do you do with the Judaism specialist? You come, you know, and you say, oh, I've got this thing in my elbow, a Jewishness. Can you take care of that, rabbi?" You know, oh, not right, Judaism specialist. I mean, what's a Judaism specialist? So already, I was in trouble, right? Because I didn't want to be called Judaism anything. I just want to be another person on the staff. I knew if I was identified with Judaism, then I'd be identified with a whole lot of the baggage that they have with Judaism. All right, well, so I started thinking of programs that I could do. And one of the first things I did is I thought of doing like a Shabbaton. I thought, yeah, great, let's get together, have a meal, sing, dance. So I went up to the president of one of the chapters, a girl who was, I guess, 16, 17. I said to her, I was thinking, you know, as a program to do a Shabbaton, you know, a Shabbat experience. So she looked at me with like shock. She said, "Shabbat? Shabbat? Do you mean no tearing toilet paper? That was the first thing that came to her mind when I said Shabbat. And it just shocked me. So I turned to her, I said, well, of course. Of course. I mean, have you not tried that? It's incredible. I mean, don't you know that 2,000, 3,000 years, Jews get together Friday night and they put a roll of toilet paper in the middle of a table, right? And they sit around it meditating, right? And they work on, it's really a transcendental experience. And they basically go through this whole mantra, don't tear it, don't tear it, don't tear it. Have you not experienced Shabbat? I mean, you've got to try this. And she looked at me like, cut it out, right? But that's what really came to her mind when I said Shabbat. She thought toilet paper. You know what she then asked me? And I'm not joking. She said, can I ask you a question? Something I've always wanted to know. I said, sure. She said, I mean, on Shabbat, are you allowed to flush? Are you allowed to flush? I said, yes, you are. She said, well, thank God. So, I saw that she was starting to get a more positive feeling about Shabbat now that she knows that you can flush, even though you have nothing to wipe with. I mean, wait, this is crazy, right? Absolute crazy. But these are the things that are going on in the Jewish community. That when we say God, there is all kinds of stuff that comes up and we're very often not even aware of it. Because we don't even assume anything else could come up. Right? We say Shabbat, we're not even aware of what's coming up. We say mitzvot, we don't even know what's coming up. And we assume what's coming up is what is. You know, I once went to a fellow who's a handwriting analyst. Very interesting fellow. And in this analysis that he does, he asks you to draw a picture of a tree on the back of the page. So there's three of us sitting around a table as we are filling out this application. Or it's not an application, whatever, this test. And, okay, so we turn over, start drawing a tree. Right? So one guy starts drawing this little tiny tree in the left-hand corner of the page. Now the guy beside him starts drawing this huge tree in the middle of the page. Well, the guy who draws this huge tree looks over at the guy drawing the little tree and he says, hey, excuse me, you didn't read the instructions. He said, oh, I didn't? He says, no, what are you doing drawing this tiny tree on the left side of the page? I mean, he doesn't want that. He wants a tree on the page. Look at mine, right? That's the kind of tree he wants. The guy says, oh, I'm sorry. So he rubs it out and he starts drawing a big tree in the middle. We don't realize how locked we are into the way we see things. And we're so sure that that's the way things look. And that is the first step or the first stumbling block to really starting to grow. If you really want to grow, you've got to get in touch with what you think you already know. And be willing to ask whether it's really the way it is. And is it the only the way it is? I don't know if you've ever experienced this. I remember when I was in high school, I was walking in a shopping mall. And I saw my math teacher. And I was shocked. Do you remember something like this? Like seeing your math teacher, your biology teacher? And I was shocked. Because I said, what is she doing here? I mean, you know, really, what is she doing here? And so I walked up to her and I said, hi, Mrs. Very, how are you? She says, fine, David, good to see you. Now, she's with these little kids and this older woman and this man about middle age. And I say, well, who are these students? You know, I didn't know you taught kids. She said, I don't teach kids. These are my children. I went, children, I mean, you're a mother? I thought you were a math teacher. Of course, I didn't say this, but I thought this. And I said, well, who is this man beside you? She says, "This is my husband."
"You mean you're a wife? And this little old lady next to you?
Right? Is she like a principal of a school?"
"No, she's my mother." "You mean you're a daughter? And I thought you were a math teacher."
That surprise is just a perfect example how we take our definitions and consider them to be absolute reality. And it's really based on a very narrow, very limited encounter, an experience with somebody. And we've already clarified it, we already know, we've already defined it. That's who they are, that's what it is, and I can't get beyond it. I can't get beyond it. That, unfortunately, is what's going on for a lot of Jews about God, Judaism, Israel, Torah. It's all kinds of definitions that we have already formulated. We may not even realize how graven these images are, and how they are stifling our ability to be happy about being Jewish and genuinely proud about being Jewish. Right? I've asked people to imagine a Torah sage. Just imagine, give me a picture of a Torah sage, a holy person. Most people, when they imagine a Torah sage and a holy person, they imagine a man. How many people here imagined a man? Yeah, that's a lot of people, right? Why couldn't it be a woman? There are women that are Torah sages also. Most people, when I say a Torah sage, right, most people think of an old man. How many people here thought of an old man? It's a lot of people. An old man. You know? A lot of times when I ask them to really visualize this person, very often he's actually wearing thick glasses. But what are people imagining? You say Torah sage, holy person, you begin to imagine old. Now, I mean, is that an attractive image? When I was growing up, for me, the image of a Jew, of like a Torah Jew, was so clear to me. It was a picture in my living room. I only realized this later on in my life, that there was a picture in my living room which had determined for me my image of what a Torah Jew looks like. It's a picture my parents bought in Israel, and it's basically a picture of these three rabbis learning, you know, Torah. And they've got these big books piled up on the table, and they're old with long white beards, and they're kind of bent over, and they've got glasses, and they're in this discussion, this Talmudic discussion, and one looks like an umpire that's going, "You're out!" You know? The other one's going like this, "No!" And the other one's going like this, "Ay!" And to me, that was Judaism. Do you think that would interest me? Do I want to see myself in that picture? No. It's for that picture alone that I would say stifled my openness in getting more involved as a Jew, because I said, I don't see myself in that picture. I don't want to be in that picture. I don't want to be old, right? I don't want to be in this room that doesn't look very attractive. I don't want to be sitting over these books that don't seem very relevant. I don't want to be involved with some kind of Talmudic discussion of minute details that have nothing to do with my life. I don't want that. But that was my stuff. And that was somebody's dumb picture, right? I mean, it's not necessarily a dumb picture. This I thought was. But there's some very beautiful pictures. But that's the only picture. Why? And I'm locked. And I have to be able to get past it if I really want to know about God, about an afterlife, about a Torah, a mitzvah, Shabbat, Yom Kippur. Every single of these words are pushing buttons in every single person in this room. And you know, a lot of it is probably negative. We might not even know. Hopefully some of it's positive, maybe a lot of it's positive. But you know, when I was working with this Jewish youth organization, I did a little poll. I asked the members if they went to Hebrew school, and I asked them if they enjoyed it, right? I found that most of the people I asked did not enjoy it. Now, I didn't enjoy it. I went to Hebrew school. When I was very young, I was told that I am part of the chosen people. And because of that, I have been chosen to go for another 2 hours every day after school to go learn about Judaism. Because I'm chosen. I felt just wonderful. Felt really great about that. All my friends, they got out of school at 3 o'clock and they go and watch, you know, their superheroes. Batman, Superman, Bugs Bunny, you know what I mean? And I'm gonna go read this book about Moses and Aaron. I mean, who could split the sea? To me, in my childhood mind, big deal. Superman would have picked them up and flung them over. You know? I mean, they weren't superheroes for me. You know? And so I really didn't enjoy Hebrew school at all. You know? But I do remember egg challahs and apple juice Thursday afternoon. That I did like. But other than that, I didn't really like. I didn't like Hebrew school. So I was left with certain images of what Judaism means, certain experiences that Judaism feels. And that's really serious stuff, right? It's not like interesting little stories. These are important stories. They go right into the core of who we are, and we're very often not even aware of it. So, you know, we had an ad campaign. I mentioned to you a little bit about it yesterday. It was a big poster that had in big letters, "Want to love it." Yeah, a lot of people want, what? You know, so people would read the ad. And it basically said, "Want to love it?" Many of us Jews just simply don't love being Jewish. Maybe we're proud, but does it excite our minds, warm our hearts, spark our souls? And so we put this poster out in the street, and within an hour, the first call came in, right? I said, "I'd like to meet you. I'd like to find out more about this." Okay, get together. And I'm shocked. It's a religious Jew, right? It's a guy with a black hat, right? And a black coat. Looks like a religious Jew. You know, that, of course, is another stereotype. You say religious Jew, you think of a black hat and black coat as if that's the only image. But this is what the fellow looked like. And he comes with this poster and he says, "Who is this for?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, I've been religious for quite some time, but when I read that poster, I realized that I don't love it. I mean, I'm living it, but I'm not loving it. Is this for someone like me?" Right? And I said, "Well, I realize, yes, it is." You know, I mean, it's true, this fellow, in a Talmudic way, was very advanced in terms of Jewish law, incredibly knowledgeable. In terms of Jewish practice, very committed. But the soul was missing for this fellow. He did not love it. And so here's this guy and he joins Israelite. And it seemed a little out of place because he's been learning for quite some time. Now he's sitting in a program with people, most of the people had very little background. And he had extensive background. There he is sitting and he goes through the whole program and he learns with Israelite. I mean, he's no longer religious, but I thought that was... No, I'm just joking. Met an attractive girl and... All right. It was quite remarkable. It was quite remarkable that can happen. That a person can be involved in Judaism and not really love it. Not really enjoy it. But then again, a lot of people don't believe they could, or they should. You know, many years ago, I was in yeshiva for about 5 years. I was studying. I got my rabbinical ordination. And I was young. I was 23. And I thought I'd like to go out and start teaching. But I wasn't sure what was the right thing to do. I wasn't married yet, and I wasn't sure. It's only 5 years of learning. And, you know, and maybe it's too early. What is my responsibility? So I thought, well, I'll go ask a great Torah sage, a great Torah scholar. I went to Rabbi Eliashiv. Eliashiv is considered to be one of the greatest Torah authorities of our generation. I was a little nervous. It was a very serious question. I'm going to ask him, what is my responsibility? What does God want from me? You know, I'm sitting in yeshiva. I'm studying Judaism. And what is my responsibility? There are so many Jews out there that know little about Judaism. I feel I would like to be part of sharing what I've learned. On the other hand, maybe I haven't learned enough. Maybe I should be sitting in the yeshiva and continue learning. So the rabbi turns to me and says, you have no responsibility right now to go out to the community, right? But you should sit and learn. Well, when he gave me that answer, I don't know, but I must have made a very contorted face, like, ugh. And he looked at me and he said, what's wrong? And I just spontaneously said, but I'm not happy sitting and learning anymore. I want to go out. So he turns to me and he says, well, so then why are you asking questions? I thought that's quite remarkable for a man whose job is everyone asks Torah sages questions. And I said, oh, I beg your pardon. So why are you asking questions? Well, because I want to know what is it that God wants me to do? He says, well, of course God wants you to be happy. And you didn't tell me you weren't happy in the yeshiva. And I didn't realize I could tell him that. I didn't even think, it didn't even dawn on me that that would be a factor in the question. That was the first time I ever heard a rabbi say, God wants you to be happy. You know? Could you imagine, had I not made that contorted face, can you imagine if he wasn't sensitive enough to see that on me? I would have walked out of his office, sit in yeshiva for another 10 years and be miserable? Feeling so holy that I'm so holy, willing to be miserable? Crazy, right? But that was my stuff. I didn't even think you could say to a rabbi, I'm not happy. I didn't even think that was a consideration in the halakhic terminology that you should be happy. He said, of course you should be happy. If you're not happy sitting and learning and you'd be happier going out and teaching, don't you think teaching's important? I didn't know that was a factor. Of course God wants you to be happy. I never even identified the word happiness with God, right? It was very unfortunate. I was very fortunate to meet a rabbi like that. But these are images that we're stuck with. We don't even realize it. I once had another question, not as serious a question in terms of my own life, but a particular legalistic question. So I decided, well, I really should go ask a Torah sage. So I'm thinking, I ask around, I'm told, there's this great, great Torah sage. Now, you know, what was in my mind of what a Torah sage looks like? And you imagine that one of the great Torah sages, Rabbi Rosenthal. So I'm thinking, wow, maybe I could get in, maybe I can't get in, I don't know. Well, I'll try. So I get to the place of Rabbi Rosenthal, I knock on the door, a fellow opens the door, I say, I would like to make an appointment with Rabbi Rosenthal, who I know is one of the great Torah scholars of our generation. The fellow says, I'm going to see if he can see you now. Shock. See me now? What kind of great rabbi could that be? You can't see me now. Really? See me now? Okay, fine. So he comes out and says, yes, he'll see you. I'm going, oh, wow. Great. All right, fine. So I walk into this room, and I see this, an elderly man, lying on a bed, right, with his head propped up on his hand, and he's got books on the bed, and he's writing away. So I look at this man, he gets up, he puts on his slippers, right, comes towards me, he says, Shalom Aleichem, welcome, welcome. And I'm saying to myself, well, where's the rabbi? Who's this nice little gentleman over here? So I said, I've come to see Rabbi Rosenthal. He says, I'm Rabbi Rosenthal. Again, that shock of my solidified images. I mean, you're a rabbi? I mean, I expected some man sitting on a kingly throne. I expected meeting someone who I feel very intimidated in front of. And he was so warm, he was so beautiful, and I say, well, okay, fine. I said, well, I have this particular question I'd like to ask you. So he said, go ahead. So I asked him the question, and he stops. He goes, oh, that's such a good question. I say, yeah? Yeah, it's a great question. So I said, well, what's the answer? He says to me, what do you think? Now I'm saying to myself, do I go to great Torah sages for them to ask me what I think? I thought that was really wild. So I started to think. you know, well, he asked me to think, so I started to think. So I'm thinking, well, what would I think would be the answer? So I think about it. I said, well, I think that it should be this way. He listens so warmly and so lovingly, and he says, I don't think that way. Oh, no, you don't? No. Okay. But that was, for me, a wonderful surprise. It's unfortunate it had to be a surprise. That when I said Torah sage, I had these images. That had I not met a Torah sage, I would have been locked in these images. Right? I might not have even tried to meet a Torah sage, because I would have had all these images of such fear and such intimidation that I could be so imprisoned. You know, the other day, I took my kids to the zoo. And I met a friend there. I hadn't seen him in a while. So we were looking, actually, at the monkeys. And he said, you know, do you realize why in front of the cage is this moat of water? He said, I mean, look at this cage. It's not a cage. They could get out of this cage. I mean, really, if they want to get out, they could get out. So why don't they get out? Because they're afraid of water. Right? And that's why they put this water in front of them. Because they're afraid of water. He said, now realize that if, God forbid, there was a fire in there, they would overcome their fear and they would be able to get across it. They would have to get across that water, and they would. They're able to get across it. Do you realize what keeps them in their cage? It's their fears. That's the teaching. It's their fears that imprison them. There's nothing else but their fear. And there are a lot of fears that we have about what happens if I do meet a Torah sage? What happens if I do explore the meaning of God, the meaning of life, the purpose of life, the meaning of Torah, the possibility of relationship, the possibility of revelation? Are there fears that are imprisoning us? And there are. I was afraid of Torah scholars. I never really met one. But I saw one. He was hanging in my living room. I saw three of them, and they didn't look like interesting people that I would like to meet. And when I met, wow, it was a completely different experience. And I realized, wow, I'm so locked. So I had another huge question once. And this was a very personal question. And I wanted to go ask a great Hasidic master, a Kabbalistic personality. And I was really trembling, whoa, you know. And so I asked around, who can I meet? So someone tells me, there's a great, great Hasidic master by the name of the Zaviller Rebbe. So I'm thinking, oh, the Zaviller Rebbe. We're off to see the Rebbe. The wonderful Rebbe of Zvil. So I start off on this journey to find the Rebbe of Zvil, you know? And so I know he's in Me'er Sharim. Now, where else could he be? I figured he must be there. So, well, I go there and I start asking for the Rebbe from Zvil. And so people say, oh, the Rebbe of Zvil. You want to see the Zvil or Rebbe? Well, you've got to go, you know, Yamina, Smola, Smola, Yamina. One of those perfect Israeli directions. You know, you want to go right, left, left, right, left, right. And of course, I get lost. And so I meet somebody else on the street. I say, excuse me, I'm trying. Have you heard of the Zvil Rebbe? Have I heard of the Zvil Rebbe? Oi, the Zvil Rebbe. I mean, oi, great, great. Oh, he's such a holy man. He's such an unbelievable deep soul. Wow, wow. You know, so, okay, fine. So he says, left, left, right, 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 right. All right, now I find these little kids playing on the street. So I'm looking for the Zvil Rebbe. The little kids go, oi, the Zvil Rebbe. Oi, the Zvil Rebbe. You want to, oi, you know, they go down, 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 down. Finally, you know, I'm standing in front of this apartment building. And this is where it is. So there's this young fellow, you know, religious looking fellow. He's walking up the stairs. I say, excuse me, I am looking for the Zvil Rebbe. He says, oh, I can take you there, right? So, oh, great. So we're walking up the stairs. I said, you know, I was a young guy, and I said, have you ever met this Zvil Rebbe? He says, you might say so, yes. So, okay. So he gets to the door. He says, this is where this Zvil Rebbe lives. I said, okay. He takes keys out of his pocket. So I said, oh, you work for this Zvil Rebbe? Oh, wow. You know, I think, oh, this is his assistant. That's great. So, you know, he doesn't answer the question. He opens the door. He says, you can just go down to the back and go to the left. There's a room there. okay, fine, so I sit in this room, and all my images, my fantasies are flying, you know, because I'm going to watch this man, he's going to walk in, and it's just going to be full of fire, and it's just going to be light beaming, and oh my gosh, and my heart is racing, and this young fellow walks in the room, sits across the desk, and says, "Hi, how can I help you?" I said, "I'm looking for the Zvila Rebbe." He says, "I'm the Zvila Rebbe." And I was, again, that shock that I was stuck in what I thought a Rebbe should look like, a great Kabbalistic master should look like. But you know, when you think of King David, you know, a great biblical image, right? Very rarely do people even think of King David as old. People think of King David as young, attractive, exciting. He's a poet, he's a musician, he's a warrior, he's a lover. Is he Jewish? That's the question, yes. And that is an authentic image of a Jewish personality, but something happened over time. We got stuck in certain images. We got trapped in very narrow experiences. We've had, unfortunately, right, some bad experiences. And they can really get in the way. Really get in the way. I got a letter from a woman who wanted to do Israelite. She said, "Dear Rabbi, I've been living with a non-Jew for 5 years. We were engaged, and about a month before the wedding, I decided I couldn't marry him. And so I turned to my boyfriend, Tony, and I said, 'Tony, I can't marry you.' So he said, 'Why?' I said, 'Because you're not Jewish.' He said, 'Betty, we've been living together for 5 years. We love each other. And you've always confided in me the fact that you hate Jews.' She said, 'That's true, I do, but I can't marry you because you're not a Jew, right? And so, dear Rabbi, I broke up with the man I love, and I don't know why. I broke up with the man I love for an identity I hate, and I don't know why. So do you think this seminar would be for me?' Right? Dear Betty, get on the first plane. Come on over, fast." Well, anyway, so Betty's accepted in the program. And the orientation classes, she doesn't show up. So I'm wondering, where is this woman? And she actually shows up at my home at lunchtime. And she says, "Oh, my name's Betty. I applied to this program, but I decided not to do it." I said, "Oh, why?" She said, "Well, you know, let's go talk about this." Okay, fine. So we're talking, and she says, "Well, really, I just realize I'm not a religious personality." I said, "What has that got to do with it? What are you talking about?" She says, "I'm not a religious personality, and therefore I realize that this would not be a seminar for me." I said, "Well, let's talk a little more. I mean, if I remember correctly, I read this letter from you, and you were like living with this guy for 5 years, and then you decided to break it off. That sounds pretty religious." I mean, talking about religious personality, talking about even blind faith. I mean, why did you break up with Tony? She said, "Oh, Tony, that's an old story. Now I'm going out with Baruch." Right? Oh, Baruch. All right, that'll solve the problem, right? Right? That's Baruch. All right. I said, "Yeah, but that's a very serious thing. I mean, that must have been very traumatic at the time. You know, so it seems to me that there's a lot of work that needs to be done to clarify your Jewish identity, and why is it that in some strange way it moved you to behave in this manner?" So I'm saying, "So what really is going on? Why is it that you don't want to do this?" So she's hemming and she's hawing, and I'm pushing. I'm trying to ask, "Well, what is going on? What? Why do you not want to do this?" Her eyes start to well up with tears. Right? And I realize I'm pushing some serious buttons over here. Something heavy is going on, right? That's what you gotta learn to do. You gotta learn to read between the lines, because most people don't say what they really mean. So I say, "So what's really going on, Betty?" She said, "Don't you understand? I broke up with Tony because I have a Zaidi who was a rabbi in Poland." I said, "Yeah," as if I understand, "Yeah. Don't you understand? I have a Zaidi who was a rabbi in Poland, and I couldn't marry Tony. I said, but is your Zaidi still alive? No, he died in the Holocaust. I said, so I don't understand. I can't marry Tony because my grandfather died as a Jew. So I turned to her and I said, Betty, do you think your grandfather died for something stupid? And she said, Rabbi, that's exactly what I don't want you to confirm. And that was her problem. She was so convinced inside that Judaism really is stupid. That Judaism really has very little to offer an intellectual personality or a spiritual personality. And I said, why do you think Judaism is so stupid? And she starts spewing out all this stuff that's not true. That's not true. I can understand why she thinks it's true. I'm saddened to say that I can understand where she got this stuff. But it's not Judaism. But she was imprisoned. She was imprisoned. And so, this is really the first step. This is the first step. To try and get in touch with what do you mean, or more important, what do you feel? Because we have learned to say what we think we're supposed to say, right? We almost have to trick ourselves to really say what we want to really say when I say God, right? I want to know what it's bringing up, right? And quite frankly, I don't need to know. You need to know. What's it bringing up? When I say Torah, Shabbat, Torah Sage, Yom Kippur, Mashiach, Messiah, Orthodox, right? All these words, what does it all bring up? Because if you don't get in touch with it, everything you're going to hear for the next 3 weeks or 6 weeks is going to be filtered through all of that. And the difficulty of this process is a lot of it's emotional. You know, a lot of it really is emotional, and we know how to talk a good, you know, talk. And it's very hard. So let me give you an example. I asked a group to get in touch with their God, their childhood image of God. Try and remember your earliest association with the notion of God. You know, when I say God, I want you to think your earliest memory of what that word brings up. Right? Think about that. Okay, I asked this question to a group. I want to share with you one response. A woman in the class said, you know, when I think of God and my childhood, this is what comes up. My mother's yelling at me. I must have done something wrong. But she's yelling at me and she's running after me. And she's screaming, you bad girl, God's going to punish you. You bad girl, God's going to punish you. And so I ran away from my mother into the bathroom. And I locked the door. Right? My mother came to the bathroom. Come out of there, you bad girl. God's going to punish you. God's going to punish you. Get out of there. So I then responded, no, he's not. No, he's not. Because I'm in the bathroom. And he can't get me here because I'm in the bathroom. To which her mother then said, oh, you silly kid. God is everywhere, even in the bathroom. And this is a story she told the group. She thought it was a cute, funny story. But everybody in the group was pretty shocked. Because that's a heavy story. You know? I mean, you can't even be in the washroom in peace. He's even there. He's everywhere. Out to get you. Right? That's why Calvin and Hobbes are so funny. Because a lot of people have an image of a God who's out to get us. A punishing God. Right? It's almost like the first association for a lot of people. What did I do wrong? Why is this happening to me? And that was very serious. Now imagine, in this case, this woman over here. And this is the stuff that's inside. She's not totally aware of that. Right? On the other hand, I noticed psychologically, this girl has a tendency to oscillate between an incredible fervent faith in God and incredible denial of the existence of God. Right? Like, she's really like, sometimes she'd be like neurotic. The other hand, no, I don't believe in a God. Of course, it makes sense. She has such a sick image of God. It'd be healthier she not believe in God. Certainly not that one. It would be much healthier she doesn't believe in God. Because this God is destroying her life. Now imagine, just imagine. There are certain educators that think that it's important to prove to people there's a God. It's important to prove to people that Torah is revealed, is a revelation from God. To me, educationally, that could be a very serious mistake. Right? Why? Imagine this girl goes into a seminar, you know, and she's got this baggage. She's got this stuff about God that she's not even aware of. Right? And she's basically being able to cope with it by saying she doesn't believe in God. Well, she goes through a seminar, let's say, and the seminar proves to her in some really incredible intellectual way that there is a God. Could you imagine how frightening that would be? How shocking that would be? What a crime that would be to convince her to believe in that horrific God that she's actually been running away from her whole life? Right? It's a major mistake. And so, imagine you're walking down the street. You pick up a book. You don't know what it is. It says, you know, the front page of this book has been ripped out. But the second page says, instructions for success. Well, you want to be successful. So you start reading the book. But you really don't know what the book's about. So, first page says, proper diet. All right, well, it says, don't eat this, don't eat that, don't eat this, don't eat that, don't eat this, don't eat that. You start reading this, you got to get a headache. What? How restrictive, how horrible, right? Well, what can I eat? It says on the bottom, 3 yogurts a day. I go, oh my gosh, that's terrible. Well, I go to the next chapter. It says, you know, proper movement. Don't do this, don't do that, don't do this, don't do that. Wow. You know, next chapter, exercises to do, right? I see this person, and they've got this leg up on this bar, you know, and they're supposed to do that 100 times a day. You go, oh my gosh, I mean, this is torture. And then the next chapter says proper attire. And there's a person, and they're wearing this skin-tight suit, and they've got these little slippers on that have no soles. And you say, my gosh, I wouldn't be caught dead outside with that thing. I mean, I couldn't even, I mean, whenever it's raining, I couldn't wear those shoes. I mean, if I ever wanted to go mountain climbing, I mean, this is ridiculous, you know? Now, of course, we figure this out. This is really a book about ballet. But let's say you don't know. Now imagine someone walks up to you and sees you holding that book and says, oh, you've got that book. Yeah, I was about to trash it. No, that is the book. That is the book to success. Oh, really? Yes, I'm going to prove to you. I'm going to prove to you that you need to do this. You've got to do this. Oh, please, don't do that. And before you know it, zoom, you know, they just give you the most incredible, rational understanding of how this book is so compelling that you need to follow it and practice it. I ask you, if you were to follow that book perfectly without knowing what that book is really all about, would you ever learn how to dance? Never. Because nobody ever told you, now dance! Now dance! See, to me, that's what's happened to Judaism. It's like the front page of the book is being ripped off. People read the book, they don't know what it's about. Right? And if they follow it without really knowing what it's all about, I really wonder if they'll ever succeed. Right? I really wonder if they're ever going to succeed. It could be horrific. It could be terrible. It could be so torturous. Because I don't really know what it is. I don't know what it is. To me, this is the tragedy of Jewish education today. That the most fundamental definitions in our dictionary for spiritual growth has really been so damaged and so incomplete and is conjuring up such bad energy within ourselves, we can't get on. We just can't get on. Because these words are triggers. And we need to get in touch with what they're triggering in order to create a new trigger, a new identification, a new feeling. I'm sure you've had the experience where you were driving your car and all of a sudden you felt like depressed. Like all of a sudden you just get into this mood and you don't know why. Right? Well, psychologists say that our minds work with tremendous identification. And so what really could have happened at that moment is a song came onto the radio. And this song happened to be playing in a restaurant when you were breaking up with your boyfriend or girlfriend. Not that you knew the song was playing. It just happens to be playing. It's the background music in this restaurant. And as you're going through this real traumatic moment, this music is playing in the background. She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah. You don't even notice it, right? Well, one day you're just feeling really happy, feeling really good. You're driving down the highway. The sun is shining. It's a great day. And, you know, they now say, now the Beatles, yeah, hey, everybody, he loves you, yeah. And you're just listening, and all of a sudden you start getting really depressed, you know. And you don't know why you're feeling depressed. And because that she loves you brought up on your memory bank, accessed that feeling. And I think that's happened to a lot of us for Judaism too, with God, a lot of things. It's bringing stuff up all the time. You know, in a circus, they teach dancing bears to dance by having them walk on hot coals. That's one of the ways they do it. They get this bear to walk on hot coals. Now, of course, as it's walking on hot coals, it starts to, you know, break dance, right? It starts to, you know, shake, rattle, and roll because it's in pain. And as it's going through that, what do? They play this music, right? And what does it become? A trigger for the pain of the coals. So what happens is, now they bring out the dancing bears. Hey, everybody, the dancing bears, right? And they bring out these dancing bears. They start to play this wonderful music, right? And the dancing bears start to dance. Yeah, they start to dance. And their hearts start to cry because they're really in pain. And unfortunately, this has happened. This has happened. I have met people who are from religious backgrounds who, yes, they kept Shabbat. They put on tefillin. They prayed three times a day. Right? But the truth is, there's a lot of negative stuff that it's connected to. And that's what's getting in the way. And they've just got to run from it. But the question is that the most healthy way to do it? Okay, let's look at a couple of cute letters from children to God, which is gives you a sense of their image of God. Here's one. Dear God, this is a book called Children's Letters to God. All right? Dear God, I bet it is very hard for you to love all of everybody in the whole world. There are only four people in our family, and I can never do it. Well, that was a cute one. Dear God, maybe Cain and Abel would not kill each other so much if they had their own rooms. It works with my brother, Larry. Dear God, please send me Pony. I never asked for anything before. You can look it up. Or how about this one? Dear God, instead of letting people die and having to make new ones, why don't you just keep the ones you got now? God, the bad people laughed at Noah. You made an ark on dry land. You fool. But he was smart. He stuck with you. That's what I would do. Dear God, I do not think anybody could be a better God. Well, I just wanted you to know. But I'm not just saying that because you are God. All right, that's from Charles. So why don't you write one letter if you were a child, as a child. Try and get back. What would you write to God? What would you write? But write it with your other hand so you can try and get into the headspace of yourself as a child. Because the child is still in you. The child has never left us. There's still a child inside of us. And we need to address that. So let's try and do that.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.